Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp. I'm in today for David La Tulipe. David is taking some time off, and this is Open Air, KALW's radio magazine for the Bay Area's performing arts. Three really interesting segments today. We're going to talk to Japanese-American magician David Hirata about his solo show entitled The Jap Box. It's debuting at the Marsh Berkeley. We'll also have a conversation about the world premiere production of a play called Driven. It's a heartwarming comedy of Filipino-Americans in the Bay Area. It's from local playwright Boni Alvarez, and it's running at Theater Rhinoceros' new location in the Castro District. Plus, we'll hear about the Oakland Jazz Workshops and the 25th anniversary celebration of Jazz in Oakland. The benefit concert for the OJW is at Yoshi's, featuring some newcomers and some alumni. First up, magician David Hirata. I have the benefit of having him right here in the studio with me. So if we decide to do some magic acts, we'll just have to describe to you how they
That's
look.
Right.
Hi, David.
Hi, Renee. Thanks for having me.
What a pleasure. I don't know anybody who doesn't love magic. And David is here to talk about his tribute to a world-renowned magician whose name has in many ways faded from the history books. That magician's name is Namagoro Sumatagawa. And there was a production back in 1866 featuring Sumatagawa, who became the very first Japanese citizen in more than 200 years at that time to even qualify for a passport to leave Japan. So he was a special performer for that reason alone. He was part of the Imperial Japanese troupe, and he dazzled audiences in Victorian America and Victorian England. He had an exotic stage magic act, and he became a real media celebrity. And by the time Sumatagawa returned home to Japan, to his shock, his prize trick, the one that he created, had suddenly been appropriated by American magicians who began performing it in yellowface. And by then, his trick had been rechristened the so-called Jap Box. Well, now, over a century later, David Hirata is unveiling illusions and surprises from this very particular Japanese-American story in his latest solo act. That act is called The Jap Box. Welcome, David Hirata. So nice to have you here.
Yeah, thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's extraordinary. We're going to talk a bit about the production that you're doing now, but how did you get into magic in the first place?
Oh, it's an old, old story of the kid who got a magic set for his birthday, and I just never left it. It became part of my life. It was a passion, a hobby. For several years, it was a profession, and it's something that I've just always done. And the more I did it, the deeper I got into it, different types of magic, from sleight of hand to sort of mind-reading things, and then into the history of it, which sort of led me here to the creation of this show.
And is it appropriate to even call it magic? I don't know what the politically correct term is. Is it sleight of hand? Is it illusion? Is magic okay to even call it?
That's what I call it. I mean, if you're going to get technical dictionary definition, it's conjuring. Mm. But everyone says magic. Everyone says magician and magic, and I think that's fine.
It's an art form, though, isn't it? Or is it? Is it just entertainment, or is it really an art?
I think it can be. It depends on how it is treated. It's certainly a terrific entertainment form. And where it becomes or can become an art form, I feel has to do with what you say with it, how you use it to represent greater themes beyond a kind of novelty surprise and dazzle approach, and which is fine, of course, mm-hmm. but using it to actually try and say something, to represent something greater than itself,
What? When you say represent something greater than itself, particularly in the Japanese magician tradition.
Sure. Well, this show came about because I was aware of this prop, which when I was a kid was marketed as a Jap box.
It's a physical box?
It is a physical magician's prop.
Okay.
And as you mentioned in the intro, it would have been in the act of Namigoro Sumidagawa. It's a trick that is of Japanese origin, originally known as a sokonashi bako, is the original Japanese term for it.
Describe the box.
So sokonashi bako translates to box without top or bottom. So if you could imagine, say, something about the size, a wooden box about the size of a shoebox, mm-hmm. without a bottom, that so you can look straight through it. And it would also come with a tray that it could rest on, giving it a sort of bottom. Okay, so and it could be shown empty and things could be produced from it or vanish out of it. So this dates back to about the 18th century in Japan, and it would have been brought over by Japanese magicians in the 1860s, 1870s, would have been seen in the West for the first time. And by about 1890 or 1900, it had found its way into the repertoires of American and European magicians.
What were American magicians and Europeans doing at the time as far as their act was concerned? Was this during the time of Houdini, or is this
A bit earlier.
Okay.
Houdini was in the around 1920. So we're talking the Victorian era, 1880, 1890, up to about 1900. And stage magic was going through a real burst of change, a lot of development in the staging of it and the technology of it, and also the entertainment scene with vaudeville in the United States, music hall in Europe, gave venues for these performances, and magicians were developing techniques of optical illusions in new ways in magic. Mass production made it possible for the tools and gimmicks to be manufactured with a precision that hadn't been possible before. So a lot of fantastic things were going on in magic in the West at the time. Enter the Japanese magicians, who are performing this very traditional form that's has its roots back going centuries. The Sokonashi Bako would have been part of that. There was Namigoro Sumidagawa was famous for a trick where he would take a piece of tissue paper and cut small tissue paper butterflies out of it, fan them gently, and they would fly about like live butterflies, mm-hmm. and land on the fan and dance about. And he was actually known in the press as the Butterfly Conjurer. That was his most famous trick. Mm-hmm. Now, I've chosen to focus on the prop, the Sokonashi Bako, known as the Jap Box in my childhood, because I felt it was such a potent symbol of this story of the show that's bookended by Namigoro Sumidagawa, the first Japanese citizen to get a passport to come to America in the 1860s after Japan's two centuries isolation period during the Tokugawa era. Mm-hmm. So you have Namigoro, who comes to America, marking kind of the beginning of the story, and then me, a Japanese-American magician here in 2019. We bookend the story, and then there's a third magician who has a place in the show, Wellington Tobias, an American magician who was famous in the 1890s. And his connection with Namigoro Sumidagawa and my fascination with him.
I wish you'd brought the box, but again, I want to kind of give folks an idea of what made this illusion or this trick so special. We've seen performers who, you know, they show us the open-ended box, nothing in the box, nothing to see here. Was that the first time when Sumidagawa did it? Was that the first time that we actually saw something disappear or appear from what we thought was an empty box?
No. And in fact, at this period, the Victorian era in America and Europe, there was a kind of an explosion in the development of what we might call box tricks. mm-hmm. in the West. Sort of the idea of the large cabinet, phone booth size cabinet, where someone steps in and disappears, or perhaps mm-hmm. it's shown empty and they disappear, was really developed during this period. So in a way, the Soko Nashi Bako was not particularly unusual as a magic prop. What did make it noteworthy or coveted, really, by magicians at the time, was that it was Japanese, that it was this exotic object. And part of what I get at in the show is the way magicians at the time, and even still today, treat magical secrets as commodities. If you see a magician do a trick, and if I as a magician see a magician do a trick and I don't know how it's done, then that makes that trick an object of desire.
Amazing.
To me.
Amazing.
That's
yeah.
right. And I want that secret and it, perhaps the prop that makes it possible. Now, there's an ethical question. If the magician has invented it, really it should be hands off by me. But in the history of magic, it hasn't always been treated that way.
Certainly not by Sumitagawa's folks who came after him. They when he left the United States as part of this troop and went back to Japan, the next thing he knew, his signature trick had been appropriated by American magicians, which you're saying is basically unethical, right?
Yeah, we don't know. We can't know exactly how the secret of the Soko Nashi Bako made its way to the West. There is an apparent connection between Namigoro Sumitagawa and his having taught magic to some Western magicians. Now, whether he actually gave them the secret of the Soko Nashi Bako and of the butterfly trick particularly, which also became something of a fad in American magic at the time, whether that was properly passed on or not, we can't be entirely sure. What really kind of raised my eyebrows was the idea that this box of Japanese origin, which had been performed by Japanese magicians for over a century, became such a sort of staple in magic shops by the time I started doing magic as a kid, and that it was called a Jap box.
Which sounds kind of pejorative, right? And not to mention the fact that it was being performed by American magicians in yellowface. What was
yes.
that about?
Yeah, not always. I mean, there were many magicians who would just, they would perform it as themselves, American magicians or European magicians. But there was kind of this explosion of yellowface magicians starting around the 1890s, this novelty of the exotic Oriental magician. And so there's this market there. And as I also note in the show, it became kind of a fashion in the design of these props. You take an ordinary box, a magic box, whatever an ordinary magic box is, but a box that you might use to produce things from, and then all you just paint some Chinese characters on it, and all of a sudden it's to
exotic.
Audiences it's exotic.
Yeah.
And so to the magicians at the time of the Victorian era, to then take that extra step and put on the makeup just seemed like a natural next step. This is around the time Gilbert and Sullivan created the Mikado.
Mm-hmm.
And so Orientalism in art, in entertainment, was very much a part of the landscape. And so that was just what they did.
So it wasn't an insult. If anything, it may have been considered a bit of a tribute to Japanese-style magic at the time.
I think it was not necessarily an insult, and it was often done, I think, with a certain sense of respect, and sometimes not. And as I get at a little bit with the show, the term Jap at that time was simply a contraction of Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
It really becomes a racial slur during World War II. And the attitude of Americans to the Japanese in this period was a kind of interesting mix. There was a there was a genuine respect and admiration for Japanese culture if you read newspaper accounts or for instance, H.G. Wells, sometime in the 1890s, wrote a book. I believe the title was A Modern Utopia. It was a proposed utopian society. And he, as part of it, he proposed that the administration and management of this perfect society would be by administrators called samurai. And it was, he chose that to model them after the Japanese samurai out of this mm-hmm. sort of admiration for the culture. And yet there was also, at the same time, I think there was a certain condescension over Japanese because they're the people with the strange ways who eat with the little sticks. And, of course, they were non-Christian heathens. So there's a little bit of both things going on at the time.
Like you said, you've bookended this experience some 100 years later. So what did you learn from Sumitagawa and other magicians, for that matter?
What did I learn? I think the show, like all solo performance theater, it's all about the unique point of view of the writer-performer, which in this case is me. And so in a sense, it's a meditation on racial identity and being Japanese-American. And so part of what I did with this was looking at the Japanese part of my heritage and approaching it through this thing that I love that I know well, which is stage magic. And so part of what I tried to do in the early stages was to try and recreate some of Namigoro Sumitagawa's magic, particularly the butterfly trick, and taking this Soko Nashi Bako and trying to see it through his eyes as best I could reconstruct it through studying the history.
Well, I'm watching your hands, and there's something about the way magicians use their hands. I'm really fascinated by it. But, you know, it's really interesting because I think that race and identity are themselves an illusion.
Yes.
You know, not to get too, you know, put too fine a point
exactly.
on it, but isn't that the case?
Yes. And that had a lot to do with my choosing the title, which it's provocative.
It is.
And I'm a little uneasy about that. But the object of the prop, known as the Jap box, to me was a potent symbol. And there's the idea of a box. Boxes, they contain, and they also conceal, and sometimes they exclude. All ideas which relate very much to our stories of race in America. And the word Jap, which I'm a little uncomfortable using, but words themselves are boxes. They contain meaning, they contain emotion, they contain history. And so that title just resonated with so many metaphors and symbols that I didn't feel I could leave it alone. But I'm also well aware that as a live theater piece, the show itself will be in a small independent theater in the East Bay. It will be experienced by thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of people. But the title, of course, in the age of the internet, has the potential to be seen out of context by millions. And so there's a risk there that I'm very aware of, that I'm sensitive to.
Well, I look forward to seeing the actual box. I'm about three and a half feet from you. If I was this close to you when you had the box and did the performance, would I be able to see how it works? How close does the audience have to be to really get a feel for what it is that you're doing with the Jap box?
The piece, the magic with the prop, and the magic in the show is completely deceptive at any distance from about 3 feet, which is where the front row is relative mm-hmm. to me, to about 25 or 30 feet, which is the back row. Mm-hmm. So the magic in the show was created to be visible to everyone in the back, but deceptive to everyone in the front. That's That's the craft. That's a big part of the craft of being a magician.
Yeah, it is. But it also requires a willing suspension of disbelief. We have to believe that if you put something in there and it's not there anymore, it really did disappear. And that's the fun of it. I mean, I think magic appeals to kids and old folks and everybody in between for that very reason.
That is my hope. That is the intent here, yes.
It's a wonderful thing.
Yes.
David Arata, I look forward to seeing the performance. The Jackbox will be presented now through December 1st at the Marsh Berkeley. That's at 2120 Alston Way in Berkeley. And you can get ticket information by calling 415-282-3055. David Arata, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Renee.
Stay tuned. We're next talking about theater and a new play called Driven. And welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in today for David LaTulipe, and this is Open Air, KALW's radio magazine for the Bay Area Performing Arts. Aren't we lucky to live in the Bay Area, where there is just so much to do? And this week we are talking not just magic, but theater productions as well. We have a preview of Driven. It's the new production at Theater Rhinoceros. In fact, it's the first production in Rhino's new location in the Castro District. Fittingly, Driven is a play. It's by Boni Alvarez and directed by Alan Kismorio. It's a comedy about Filipino Americans in the Bay Area. So I want to say welcome to the director, Eli Urquiza.
Urquiza.
I practiced it at least three times before you got here. Thank you, Eli. Welcome. And Alan Kismorio, who is a performer in Driven. Alan,
yes.
Thanks for being
afternoon.
Here. Good. And Joe Talley, who's the executive assistant in the theater itself, yes?
That is correct.
Wonderful to have you here. So let's give the folks an idea of some of your background, starting with Eli Urquiza. Eli's a queer Filipino multidisciplinary actor, director, and he's also a teaching artist, so he helps other performers. Through theater and performing arts, Eli explores the role of the Asian diaspora and the Asian American experience, as well as the politics of queerness. All of that using theater. Also, Alan Kismorio helped create Alchemy SF, where he developed new works by Bay Area LGBT playwrights, and he served as co-artistic director of the Asian American Theater Company. And he says he is dedicating his work in the production of Driven to his late father. And rounding out Joe Talley, who's been involved in Bay Area theater since the early 90s, he's performed with Theater Rhino and Shotgun Players and SF Shakespeare Company as well, among others. And he's been on staff with Theater Rhino since 2016, and there he does programming and development. So there's a little background. We're celebrating the 42nd year, starting with you, Joe, the longest-running LGBT theater in the whole country.
In the whole country.
It's remarkable.
In the whole world that we know of.
It's remarkable. I remember when I moved to the Bay Area in 1990, I was working at KRON, and I drove past the sign that said Theater Rhino. Theater
That's
Rhinoceros.
Right. That was a longtime home on 16th Street.
On 16th Street. And I thought to myself, now what's that? Theater Rhinoceros. And I couldn't wait to see what it was about, because the theater scene, whether it was Lorraine Hansberry or Theater Rhinoceros, the Bay Area just seemed to be such fertile ground for revolutionary theater. So just talk a little bit about the history of Theater Rhinoceros itself.
Sure. Happy to. Well, it was started back in the late 70s, in 1977, because at that time, a mainstream theater, you know, like ACT or Berkeley Rep, it was considered very edgy if they were performing anything with LGBTQ content. And so it was very rare to actually see our lives presented on stage, let alone TV or film. But a group of young men and women who were passionate about theater took the opportunity of the burgeoning and developing LGBT community in San Francisco to create a space, essentially, where gay, lesbian, bisexual writers could explore their own art and experiment with it. And it also then gave those audiences, gay audiences, the opportunity to see their lives on stage as well.
Where was content even coming from back then?
They were making it up themselves, both in San Francisco and New York. There were revolutionary playwrights such as Derek Wilson. And in New York, there were places such as La Mama's that was producing a whole lot of new content and putting queer themes into it. So basically had to come out of our community itself. To a certain extent, you could go back and claim, like Shakespeare and so forth, and put queer elements in or really emphasize queer elements. But for the most part, there wasn't a huge catalog of gay plays, lesbian plays at that time, so we were creating it ourselves.
And now that it's in the Castro, fittingly, was there a reason why it moved?
Yes, we were a couple of reasons. We've always wanted to be in the Castro, which is kind of the gay mecca of the U.S. But, you know, there are really no performance spaces for live theater. There's the huge Castro Theater, which is, you know, shows films. There's a couple of music venues and there's bars. But there's been no place for live theater itself. And we've always wanted to be there. We were also looking for a more intimate space to produce shows. We had been at the Gateway Theater for the past couple of years, which is a larger theater, and fine if we're doing Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, or Sister Act. But for a smaller show such as Driven, for instance, we needed a smaller space. And we had a relationship with Spark Arts Gallery, where we've been doing staged readings for a couple of years. And we just wondered, you know, can we come in here and turn this into a performance space? Aviva Kanoff, who runs Spark Arts, was open to the idea. And so we did a couple of small, we called them pop-up productions last year. And was very popular, worked very well with the space. So we decided this is going to be our home. We'll do our main stage shows here.
And is it now the permanent home of Theater Rhino?
It's not the permanent home. It is still Spark Arts Gallery. It is an art gallery and kind of an art salon in the Castro. But we definitely have a very strong tie to it. Like I said, we've been doing stage readings there a couple of years, and now I think we're really putting our imprint on it with live theater.
Okay, let's talk about this new production, Driven. Eli, you are the director. Talk about how you got involved with this production.
Yeah, 2 years ago, we did a stage reading at Spark Arts with Alan playing also the father in the play. And I read about this play and I was so struck by the story and the realness and the truth and nuances that is around the narrative of Bonnie Alvarez's play.
What is the plot?
The plot of the play really talks about, you know, Danny, who is an actor in L.A., and having to struggle coming up in Hollywood and going back to the Bay Area to help his father, who's dealing with alcohol and gambling addiction. And in his time of going back to the Bay Area, he's having to grapple with his dad's push for him to go back to L.A., to be able to pursue his acting career. And in the meantime, finding, you know, his high school friends that reappeared in his life. So it's about really, you know, father and son relationship, and his acceptance of queerness and the arts, which is pretty, pretty, you know, interesting to look at, because we don't often have that representation in queer theater and Asian American theater. So finding that intersection in Driven was definitely a treat to explore.
For Boni Alvarez, was this autobiographical the way so many pieces are for artists?
Yes, it is sort of autobiographical. We workshopped this play multiple times with Boni, and he shared, you know, who these people are and who Kuli is, and, you know, his father through Arnell, and part of his life through Danny, the character. So it's very close to him and his roots here in the Bay Area, and his trajectory as an artist coming from his training for college and MFA and being a professional artist down in LA.
Mm-hmm. And Alan, you are an actor. Do you play more than one part?
No, I'm just playing the dad.
You play the dad.
Yeah.
How challenging is it to play that part, a man of a certain age? How old is the character that you play?
Well, he's written actually 10 years older than me, but channeling Arnell, really, the challenge was not in the age. It was in the authenticity of just the Filipino father. And it's, I kind of got a little misty-eyed when you had said on the air that I'm dedicating this to my dad, and I am. But I'm also dedicating this to all Filipinos who have immigrated here to the U.S., who have raised families here in the U.S., and the promise that they pass on to their children. And in this, you know, this story, this father passing on his hopes and his dreams to his son, and the reason why he's pushing his, you know, all this on his son, because of all the opportunities that he had left behind in the Philippines that he thought he could pursue in the U.S., and learning that it's a little harder, or there are different challenges, I should say, confronting those challenges in the U.S. as an immigrant, as someone who, you know, was hoping to find his dream, but, you know, found a little bit more of an alienation, working as, you know, as a migrant worker, when he is, you know, educated as an engineer in the Philippines. And, you know, all of that feeding into the present day, where, you know, he's being seen as an alcoholic, he is, you know, being seen as a gambler, and by that I mean that he himself may not admit that. So he's confronting all of these things too.
So he's got issues that are his personally, but there also is an intersection of his Filipino culture.
Yes.
And his relationship with his son, who's a member of the LGBT community.
That's
so
right.
How do you weave all that together?
Well, I am also part of the LGBT community, so I'm using all this experience and, you know, seeing myself through my own dad's lens, and in extension, my mom's lens and my whole family's lens. So doing this role, I sort of start to kind of look at myself objectively, and really just kind of forming like what my parents have had to realize themselves as someone who, as people have brought up a gay son.
Now, is it my understanding that the father in the play pushes his son to go back to L.A. to pursue his dreams, not pushing him away because he's gay? Is that?
That's right. His,
okay.
The father's very accepting.
He's reached a level of acceptance.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And was that the case? Because you did have to pull from your own personal experience, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have to say my own dad was also very supportive of everything I've done. I mean, he's, you know, of course he has hopes. You know, he has dreams. And, you know, he pushes all these hopes and dreams on a very stubborn son. And so, you know, that's also
Sounds
Danny,
familiar, huh?
Right?
Okay.
So a lot of that fed into how I approach the part of Arnell.
Well, it's probably very auspicious to have this production written by Bonnie Alvarez come to the theater now, because this person is actually nationally acclaimed. He's a Guggenheim Fellow now, yes?
He is. He's very much an up-and-coming young man and up-and-coming artist. I feel like we kind of discovered him and got to know him at the right time. In 5 years, we might have to go through a bunch of legal assistants and agents and so forth to even talk to him. But at this point, he's a phone call away for us.
He's in the Bay Area, yeah?
He lives in L.A., but he is a native of the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. And it's a comedy. Is that unusual in terms of how you deal with what could be pretty serious issues? An alcoholic father, you know, father-son relationships, and yet is it like laugh-out-loud funny? Was it produced that way?
Oh, it has moments of laugh-out-loud, and Eli could probably talk more about where he's mm-hmm. discovered those and actually worked to make those happen. When I first read it, I just remember thinking, what a bunch of delightful people. They were interacting, sometimes funnily. And, I mean, there's serious moments, too. Alan mentioned the stubborn son that he is, but Bonnie wrote this, the son, Danny, in this is a very stubborn man as well. And so there is a lot of conflict. And it's not all just funny conflicts. It's very much the conflict of the father has his dreams, his expectations, and Danny rebels against that a bunch. He says, "Yeah." At one point, Danny says, "You cannot put all of that on me," as the father talks about his hard work in the fields and so forth, and asking, "Why did we do it if you're just going to give up on your dreams?" But Danny pushes back and says, "You know, that you can't put that on me." So it does touch on very serious issues as well, but the characters themselves seem to find humor in their lives, and that's how they get over a lot of rough spots in the play.
Eli Urquiza, how did you walk that line between very serious issues and comedy?
Yeah, you know, like in the text, Bonnie is such a prolific playwright that he weaves and crafts all of these conversation and dialogue between characters. And the majority of the comedic bits really come from the father, who provides that comic relief in the play. And he brings such cultural nuances in the characterization. And Alan has done such an amazing job bringing that into life from the page to the stage. And you know, there are many moments in the play that really sinks deep into your heart and tugs at your heartstring between, you know, Hector, who is one of our actors playing Keeley, and Earl, who plays Danny. They just, their chemistry and their love for each other on and off stage have been so incredible to watch, and they're just so playful, just, you know, anchoring themselves in the language and the text and really finding that truth and authenticity on stage and playing with the language and the text that's already in there.
How'd you go about casting it?
Well, for casting this particular play, you know, Alan, I already have him in mind for this particular role, given that he, you know, he was the one who did the reading 2 years ago. And then we had an open call for this particular production, and we found Earl Paus, which is incredible and such a delight actor to watch. He's true to life, and he brings so much in the character. And then we also, I worked with Hector two, three years ago, and, you know, when we had an open call, this was actually the role of Keeley was actually written for a different part, but when we had trouble in terms of looking for another actor, I just opted out of, like, hey, I think you will bring such an amazing life to this character, and he was super down to play the role, the part.
Mm-hmm. And Alan, what did auditions look like? Did you have to audition, or were you just kind of a
I didn't have to audition. It was just sort of like, we like you, we want you in this, do it.
As an actor, that must have been like, wow, who gets to walk on like that?
You know, I have to tell you, you know, I've been away from actually, you know, being an actor for almost 15 years now. I wanted to be an actor. I did my, you know, I treaded the boards in San Francisco in the 90s and part of the 2000s. And then I just fell into, you know, being an artistic director for these, you know, really great theater projects. And, you know, that doing that takes you away from the performance. And there was a point where I sort of lost my way artistically. And so this is like, this is a great, this is just a great vehicle for me to come back to.
I can imagine.
Performing again.
Yeah.
But, you know, I felt like, all right, well, I have to start all over again. So when this was kind of given to me, it was like a gift. It was a present. And I looked at it as a present. And I'm really lucky that Theater Rhino and Eli thought about me for this.
Yeah, and there's not a lot of older Filipino actors in the Bay Area. And, you know, immediately I've thought of casting Alan because he's just, like, he brings so much to the roles that he's playing every time. And literally, I think you're the only person, Alan, that I know within your age range that fits that Filipino father description. Yeah,
I can't wait to see your characterization.
Right. And Eli, I have to say, there are other actors, but I killed them all. I buried them. I will not tell you where the bodies are.
What a Betty Davis move that is. Joe, let's talk before we wrap up about the rest of the season at Theater Rhinoceros.
Yeah, thanks. Well, we've got another John Fisher show coming up. Straight Guy. The Straight Eye for This Gay Guy, I think it's called, about a gay man, middle-aged gay man, who decides to run for office in San Francisco. And, of course, part of his strength is that, you know, he is gay and has been involved as an activist and so forth. But a lot of his campaign people think he's a little too gay. And so he has to get all this advice from straight people on how to be more middle of the road. And so I know John's going to have a lot of fun with that.
What's it called?
The Straight Eye.
Okay.
It's a, like, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. And again, we're doing that at Spark Arts. Then we've got Macbeth, which we're going to be doing at Yerba Buena Gardens as part of their summer festival, which is always a lot of fun. When we do Shakespeare in the Park like that, we make the audience go all over the park with us. We use various locations in the park. And so we're just going to really tear up the turf with little Macbeth and the Scottish play. And then finally, we're doing a new show of African-American lesbians. It's basically a vignette, vignettes of women. And it was written by Lorinda Brown. She wrote them essentially as short stories, and we're asking her to develop them into scenes. And so it's called Walk Like a Man. We did the first part about 5 years ago. So there were a series of vignettes, and it was just very popular. And just, again, you know, here's a population that you don't often hear a lot about. And so it was just a real delight for the actors to be able to sink their teeth into these roles. And it was really enlightening for our audiences, you know, to get a glimpse into these new lives that they probably didn't know too much about. So that'll be Walk Like a Man. That'll be back at the Spark Arts Gallery as well.
And that is in what time frame?
That is going to be in May and into June.
Okay.
We'll be running that over Pride weekend. So that should be fun to have that running in the Castro while Pride is happening as well.
Well timed. What a treat. I can't wait to see this production. Joe Talley, Eli Urquiza.
Urquiza.
Eli, thank you.
Thank you.
Urquiza. And Alan Kismorio.
Yes.
Thank you all three for being here. The production of Driven runs through November 17th, and it'll be at the Theater Rhinoceros' Castro location for the time being. Thank you all three for being here.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Look forward to it. When we come back, we're talking jazz. Stay with us. Hello, welcome back. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Open Air. I'm in today for David La Tulipe, and our next segment features the Oakland Jazz Workshops. The OJW was formed back in 1994 by renowned jazz trumpeter Khalil Shaheed. It's a nonprofit, community-based organization, and it's dedicated to the idea that this genre of music has to be passed down to a younger generation of performers and people who appreciate this form of music, and it's being passed down through actual instruction. Our guests today are Executive Director of the Oakland Jazz Workshops, Ravi Apkarian, and youth mentor and OJW alumnus, Jordan Dabney. Ravi Apkarian is the Executive Director, and he's a San Francisco-based composer and jazz bassist. He started learning guitar at the early age of 7 and then began playing bass when his high school jazz band director gave him a challenge to go ahead and switch instruments. In 1997, Ravi was invited to join the OJW as a bass teacher by the founding director himself, Khalil Shaheed. Shortly after that, Ravi was promoted to the position of educational director, and in 2011, Ravi was appointed executive director by Shaheed and the OJW Board of Directors. So you literally have come up through the ranks, Ravi. It's so good to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here, Renee.
Yeah, and Jordan Dabney, who is a mentor to the young folks coming through the system, and he's also an alumnus of the OJW. Jordan's mom is herself a performer, a choreographer and dancer, and his mom was rehearsing for a project with the founding director, Khalil Shaheed, and at that time, Mr. Shaheed invited Jordan to attend a year-round workshop for young folks at the Oakland Diamond Recreational Center. Jordan was raised in Oakland, loves music and dance as a toddler, and started playing piano at the tender age of 4. He left us for a while, went back east, spent a couple of years in New York City, and Jordan has now returned to the San Francisco Bay Area to continue his studies as a music major. And you're also looking for more opportunities to perform, I would imagine.
Always, yes? Always.
Jordan, it's so nice to have you here.
It's great
to see
be here.
This
Thank
young,
you.
Fresh face. I want to say, because, you know, I'm kind of old school when it comes to jazz, I'm looking at this fresh, young face and saying, yes, thank goodness this genre has attracted young folks. Do you find that it's unusual that, you know, people who might more be associated with hip-hop and other forms of music might be gravitating to jazz?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. From a social perspective, in some ways, it is unexpected for people my age to really gravitate towards jazz, which is why having a place like Oaktown Jazz or OJW is really nice to be with other students and aspiring musicians who are really interested in learning this tradition. But it is the basis for most of the music that's on the radio right now. People talk about samples all the time. There's all kinds of jazz, like horn licks, guitar licks, that are in hip-hop constantly. And even just the form, the chords and the purpose of the music is still very similar. So for me, it doesn't feel removed at all. But to a lot of people, yeah, I think it is unexpected.
And when you talk to your friends about it, or do you talk to your friends about it, are most of your friends in music themselves, or Or have you pulled folks in?
No, not at all. and I do talk about it pretty often because it's something that I love doing and I've been doing for a long time. I have friends that are very open to learning about a lot of things. I just happen to find those people and they gravitate towards me. So they're always interested and we share experiences with music. A lot of my friends do enjoy music, although they don't necessarily play to the extent that I do. But they seem to be pretty interested. I try not to go on too long and really burn their ears out. But to some extent, I think a lot of people my age are interested in at least hearing and knowing a little bit about jazz as the root and the history behind the music that they love, whatever style that may be.
I worry a bit about it being lost. You know, a family member, you know, we're connected. My sister's married to Count Basie's son, actually. And I've traveled a bit with the Count Basie Orchestra, and we've been to Japan and Europe, and the audiences go crazy for the music there, especially, you know, old school jazz. And I find that it's not quite as enthusiastic here in the States. Has that been your experience, Ravi, or no?
Yeah, it's something that I definitely hear from a lot of my friends that tour internationally. And, you know, we see it here in the Bay Area that it's a tough market for musicians to bring to draw the audiences that really they deserve.
Why is that, do you think?
I think that it's something that isn't really taught as part of our history in this country, and so people take it for granted. They don't understand that, as Jordan was touching on, that it's really the roots of all of the music that we listen to. It's not really acknowledged the same way that it is across the world. You know, everybody around the world understands what jazz music is, and it is a wide category. But when you talk to people here in the U.S., it's something that's unfortunately perceived as a kind of, esoteric or elitist. I think that maybe that's how it people understand it, but it's not true.
Which is really ironic, because it has certainly been music of the streets, gritty. I mean, there's nothing elitist about it, really.
No, not at all. And it's something that has really deep roots, and it's something that, you know, anybody can enjoy. And people do enjoy it, but they might not be understanding it as what we call jazz.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about the definition of that word. It seems to mean different things to different people, but let's listen to a little sample right now.
Everybody caught up in that game. You found a new way to point a finger, proclaiming you know who's to blame.
Okay, Ravi, there are those who might wonder, is that jazz? There's so many definitions of this.
Sure. Well, it's something that it's a really wide category. It's probably not the most accurate term.
Who were we just
admittedly
listening to?
That's Richard Howell, and he's going to be featured as one of the artists for Oaktown Jazz Workshop's 25th anniversary at Yoshi's on November 12th. And he's also one of our instructors. He's one of our saxophone instructors, and he's away on tour in Germany right now as we speak. So it goes back to that, you know, international recognition that we seem to lack here in the U.S.
So for those who say that's just not jazz, that it's got to be hard, straight ahead, Miles Davis for it to really be called jazz.
Well, Richard can do it all. So Richard will, you know, turn around, and this is one example of the type of music he does. But, you know, I think it's interesting. I actually went to New Orleans for the first time this summer, and one commonality I saw between New Orleans and the you know, of course, the birthplace of jazz music. And what we do here in the Bay Area as jazz musicians is that it's really all one happy family. And so, you know, mixing up a Stevie Wonder song with a Charlie Parker song is not uncommon. You know, going back and forth through the music it's not as categorized as.
And there's a lot of cross-pollinization. I know Michael Morgan, the Oakland Symphony conductor, is a board vice chair with Oakland Jazz Workshops, Oaktown Jazz Workshops, yes? So to what extent do these musical communities overlap and support each other?
Well, I think we're really fortunate here in the Bay Area that we're all very open to it. And I've gotten that feedback from some of my friends that spent decades in New York as musicians. And when they came out here, they had to recalibrate, and they had to learn a lot more Brazilian music. They had to learn, you know, kind of a wider range. And so it's something that we're very comfortable with, going between reggae, going between jazz, going between blues. And there's so many artists here in the Bay Area that do that comfortably. Of course, everything has a certain style and a certain tradition to it. It's something that is really just, you know, it's because they're all coming from the blues, because they're all coming from the jazz, it's from jazz music. It's something that all these different styles that we see as unique styles, they have that commonality. So I think that's what makes jazz music so flexible.
Jordan Dabney, you've got young folks coming to you. One of your titles is youth mentor. Mm-hmm. So how young is your youngest, and how do you get them immersed in this genre?
So not that young, actually. With Oaktown Jazz, I mostly work with the performance group, which meets on Wednesdays. We're older, mostly in high school, I think. But one of the things also about this program is that age isn't really huge. We don't talk about how old we are. Mm-hmm. We talk about how well we play. That's what matters. And that's true. That's always been true of jazz as a style, I think. Like, people have been called, you know, some people, you look at people playing on albums and you're like, wait, you do the math and you're like, this guy must have been 17 when he cut this record with, like, you know, Art Blakey. And all of these people, young people, are brought into the room because their age is not that important. It's about what you can play and how you can play. So a lot of the times it's not me that brings them in. They're already interested and excited about learning in that Wednesday group, learning and growing as musicians. And it's my job to give what I've learned as feedback and to help hone them and expand the way they think about jazz playing and listening to each other.
It's remarkable that I once again see a young, fresh face associated with this genre. Jordan Dabney, youth mentor, and Ravi Abakarian, executive director at the Oaktown Jazz Workshops. Thank you both for being here. The 25th anniversary and concert will be at Yoshi's. The 25th anniversary concert will be there on November the 12th at 8 p.m. So go out and support Oakland's jazz scene. Again, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And that's Open Air for this week. I've been your host, Renee Kemp, sitting in for David LaTulipe. And we have a reminder, all the shows here are archived at kalw.org. And if you have a suggestion, send an email to David at kalw.org. Engineer Jane Marie, thank you. And Neil Swinkles, thank you so much for producing a great show. Thanks for listening.
The BBC News Hour is coming up next. It was recorded an hour earlier for broadcast now on 91.7 FM KALW San Francisco. It's 2 p.m.